Hello and welcome to another episode of The Damage Report, a talk show where we talk for better or for worse. Today, I'll be playing the worse, the better, played by Anna Kasparian. How's it going, Anna?
Pretty good, pretty good. Can't complain. We're super close to that Thanksgiving break. You know, every time something annoying happens, I just try to remind myself we're almost there. 4 days off in a row. We're almost there.
Importantly, we're going to be getting into the Thanksgiving spirit at the close of the show. We're going to be going through some of the things that we're most thankful for. We've also gotten a number of comments from our audience about what they're thankful for. Obviously, everybody watching us, thank you for those who've already joined us, whether you're on Twitch or YouTube, the members thing, all that. It's a non-traditional show. Anna beat me up and took my setup today. So she's sitting in my chair and I'm in a room where boxes are kept, I guess.
Yeah, I feel pretty terrible about it. So John asked me yesterday, are you gonna come in studio to do the show or are you gonna do it from home? And ideally, I get to do it from home, right? But my husband just got a new job that requires him to also work from home in the same space and he needs to be on the phone, which would be a little bit distracting.
Well, that's the pandemic. But no, we're glad, you know, everybody's been able to keep a job. No, I'm kidding. This is actually where I do most of my work when I'm not on the show. So I'm perfectly comfortable here. Got my coffee, got everything. You know what you should get, everybody watching this? You should get your finger on the clicker that clicks on the like button and let people know that we're live. Because many people, hundreds of thousands of people have signed up for notifications when we go live. And YouTube has decided that that really shouldn't mean anything. But if you hit the like button, maybe they'll find out about it. And that would be awesome. All that said, feel free to send us tweets and comments and super chats and all that. We'll be responding as we go. But with that, Anna Kasparian, why don't we launch into the news of the day?
Let's do it.
Okay. Yesterday, the transition to the Biden presidency began because Emily Murphy decided, hey, you know what? Maybe I'll do my job. At some point, I'll do my job. And in addition to that, the transition actually launching, breaking news this morning, Pennsylvania has certified the vote. That follows just a couple days ago, Michigan doing the same. So in every way that matters, this thing is basically being wrapped up. The question is, when is the president and his cabal of losers and goons, when are they gonna wrap this thing up and accept that we're moving on? Technically, and I'm gonna keep this to a bare minimum, Trump's response, because I know there's literally no one in the world that hates what Trump has to say more than Anna Kasparian. But in response to Emily Murphy announcing that the GSA was going to start doing the actual transition, allow the Biden team to start coordinating with, for instance, the pandemic response group, get the money they need to do security clearances and stuff like that. Trump tweeted, I want to thank Emily Murphy at GSA for her steadfast dedication and loyalty to our country. I mean, that's him being nice, I guess, but she's finally not blocking it. That's the most steadfast and loyal she's been. But anyway, he acknowledges that she's been harassed, threatened, and abused, while pointedly not pointing out who has been harassing, threatening, and abusing her, and says that our case strongly continues. So apparently, according to sources behind the scenes, Donald Trump got to the position where he would allow this transition to go forward because of one very important stipulation that was made clear to him. In conversations in recent days that intensified Monday morning, top aides told the president the transition needed to begin. He did not need to say the word concede, they told him, according to multiple people briefed on the discussion. So once he was reassured by all of his representatives that he didn't need to formally concede, he decided to stop blocking this transition from happening. And I know that you, I believe, responded to this live on the main show yesterday, but what do you think about this? Is it over? Does it matter? Are we any closer to a return to normalcy than we were 48 hours ago?
I think we're inching closer to it being over, but it depends on what you are referring to when you say it, right? Like, is it over, meaning Biden is the president-elect, he will be inaugurated on January 20th? Yeah, I think that's pretty clear at this point. Whether Trump wants to believe it or not, his statement was a concession. The transition process has begun. Fox News hosts have already acknowledged that Biden is president-elect. But is it over in regard to Donald Trump kind of dropping off the face of the earth? No, that's unlikely. And Trump is part of the problem, but the other part of the problem is that the media just loves doing these insane, superficial, unbearable stories about his tweets. Mm-hmm. Because he's gonna keep tweeting insane things. Mm-hmm. And Trump brings in the ratings for these cable news networks, for instance. And so they're gonna keep talking about his tweets. It's gonna continue getting pitched in my morning meetings. I'm gonna continue wanting to like shoot myself. Like I can't take it anymore. I feel like the last 4 years have consisted of me trying to not only maintain my sanity, but since we spend so much time on garbage that doesn't mm-hmm. require any thinking, like any monkey can talk about Trump's tweets. Mm-hmm. I feel like I have to do a lot of extra reading and research and work outside of work just to keep my brain stimulated. That's how mm-hmm. dumb this administration has been.
Yeah, I get your frustration. Maybe you will get what you want, because maybe in all the ways that matters in terms of the actual transition happening inside of the federal government, as well as he lost more cases over the last 24 hours. So the judicial path, I guess, to him remaining president seems to be closing too. The issue is that at least as of right now, technically he is still the president for the next 2 months. He isn't doing the job. And he also, by the way, importantly, unless I believe he spoke very briefly earlier today, but it was over so fast I didn't even see it, hasn't answered a single question from the press since the election. And it's not like any of the challenges that face our country have gone away. As of right, like in the past, I totally agree with you. Right now, this is literally all that we have. The only window we have into the madman who hopefully has given up his long shot bid to remain president despite the will of the people. But this is the only information we're getting out of there, is the occasional anonymous aide and something that, you know, he tweets or whatever. Like he's certainly not talking to the press.
Yeah, no, I mean, it does. You're right. Trump retweeting Randy Quaid and his lunacy is important. It really is. I mean, it gives us a peek into what Trump is thinking. We already know.
Holiday movies growing up, Anna. This is a hard day for some of us. I liked Independence Day. I still tear up.
I don't even know who Randy Quaid is, and I don't even care. Like, okay. I hate the news cycle so much. And I know I'm being like extra bitter today when I should be happy that, you know, things are moving along in the old direction of a Biden cabinet that's just littered with all sorts of people who were in Obama's administration and were pretty disastrous in Obama's administration as well. But whatever, better than Trump. Yeah. Sure, and we'll have 4 years to critique all of the mistakes that the intentional terrible decisions the Biden campaign or Biden administration will be making. But for me at this point, I think what should be clear to everyone who likes to acknowledge reality is that Donald Trump never once cared about anyone other than himself. Now that he has lost the general election, he is MIA or playing golf. He doesn't care to do anything in regard to stimulus, which is so desperately needed right now. Americans desperately need financial relief, a bunch of protections, including eviction protections and things like that, are set to expire at the end of this year. And it doesn't appear that he cares, doesn't appear that he wants to do anything about it. The only policy related moves I see him making right now, and I'm sure you'll appreciate this, John, is essentially trying to find ways to drill on public lands and, you know, destroy our environment further. So that's who Trump is. He's always looking for a way to make a buck, but he doesn't care about the American people. He doesn't care about his own family members. He couldn't even keep them safe from coronavirus. That's who that man is. And I just want to get to a point in this country where we don't have to hear from him ever again. But unfortunately, hey, the news industry needs to make money. And if he's mm-hmm. putting out lunatic tweets, we'll be covering them for years to come.
Well, at least 57 days. We do have the inauguration of 57 days. Yeah, you're right. Trying to rush through the drilling in Anwar, now trying to rush through the permitting process for I forget exactly which Native American group it is, but some important site there. They want to like rush through the permits for mining rights there. Like there's all these articles about just trying to set so many fires in terms of foreign policy that Joe Biden won't be able to do anything aside from trying to put them out, which I personally think he could set his own fires and probably will. I wouldn't worry too much about that. But yeah, and the funny thing is, in terms of what he's actually doing, because he's not, the federal government isn't functioning in the way that it's supposed to. He doesn't care about the pandemic. It's not actually happening. He's not actually going to work. He's not meeting with people. They're firing people, and you know, they're doing some stuff like that. But what seems so odd about it is there was a bit of Tucker Carlson's monologue last night where he said one of the things that infuriates him the most about the media's collusion with Kamala Harris and Joe Biden is that neither of them ever said why they wanted to be president or what they would do. And the media allowing them to get elected without ever having to say what they wanted to be president for, that is the biggest election fraud of all. Which seems odd because I'm sure you covered how many times was Donald Trump asked by friendly interviewer Sean Hannity, what's your agenda for your second term? And he would just answer some other question, like he couldn't think of anything. And now he's not gonna have a second term, but he does have 2 months where he's still gonna be the most powerful person in the world. And he doesn't really seem to care. Like he doesn't, what does he want to do? Maybe he'll pardon himself. That really is the only big thing that we have any reason to believe he's thinking about at this point, which just seems so odd. Like I think about you, and I know you have very little interest in being engaged in politics. You wouldn't run for president. But if you were handed it for 2 months, you'd find something to do at that time. And he doesn't, he has no interest in any of it. The serious function of the government or even the weird, abrasive, damaging, corrosive way that he's run it so far in his first term, he basically is just checked out.
Yeah, he's just checked out. He's very much the type of person who likes to take his ball and go home. I just love the imagery because it really does symbolize who Donald Trump is as a person. Just like this bitter, sore loser who even in this position of power has decided, no, I'm mad. I'm gonna go play golf, or I'm gonna hide out in my basement, right? That's who Trump is. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned having 2 months in this position of being the most powerful person in the world. You can actually, as we've learned through the Trump administration, do quite a bit through executive orders. And yeah, I mean, I would go to town. I would. But that's the thing, like I would go to town because I get pleasure in making the country a better place, right? Not just for myself, but for everyone. Yeah. I get pleasure over the idea of walking outside of my home and not seeing giant homeless encampments. I like the idea of people being housed. I like the idea of people having stability in their lives. But Donald Trump has never cared about any of that because he's never known what it's like to struggle. He's never known what it's like to actually have to work for what he has. Yeah. His papa handed over $413 million for his inheritance. And then he proceeded to go bankrupt several times, six times. And Deutsche Bank still gave him massive loans, even though he was a proven failure. Donald Trump is the epitome of everything that's wrong in American culture, right? Where someone like him who was born into wealth can continue to fail upwards to the most powerful position in the country. That's who Donald Trump is. That's what this country has enabled. And I think we need to change that. The question is, can we and will we?
Yeah, I almost put a story in the rundown about Elon Musk, how he's now surpassed, I think it's Bill Gates, become the second richest person. And Tesla is valued at, I think they said $500 billion. And when I saw the headline, I thought, give me a Molotov cocktail, let's burn this thing down because it's all BS. None of it means anything. Tesla's not worth $500 billion, that doesn't mean anything. This hasn't been a good year for Tesla. Like he has been so aggressively idiotic all year. The whole thing is just really frustrating. The incentives, it's all about the incentives, and the incentives are all BS.
I love that phrase, aggressively idiotic. I'm gonna use that, it's so good.
Like he said, you know, I think that by the end of April, the COVID cases will be down to basically zero. And then he just kept doubling down and doubling down. Our country is full of people being showered with wealth for being aggressively idiotic and wrong about things that got people killed. And it just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what they say. And we certainly see it in right wing media, which is what we're gonna turn to now. Okay, as Donald Trump is being pushed closer and closer to having to, if not acknowledge reality, at least flee from reality and from the White House, we now turn to the various elements of his base of support to see how are they processing their fantasies sort of being pulled down one after the other. Some are trying to be their version of honest about it. So take a look at this. This is Laura Ingraham from last night.
You see it there. And as unpleasant and disappointing as these past 3 weeks have been to so many of us, as much as we wish things were different, this is where things stand tonight. Now, legal challenges continue in a number of states. Serious questions about vote counting, poll watcher access are outstanding. But unless the legal situation changes in a dramatic and frankly an unlikely manner, Joe Biden will be inaugurated on January 20th. Now, to say this does not mean I don't think that this election was rife with problems and potential fraud. And to say this does not constitute being a sellout to the conservative populist movement that I've been fighting for, I don't know, 25 years. And it does not mean that I disagree at all with the president's right and obligation to pursue all legitimate legal challenges to this outcome. To say this constitutes living in reality. And if I offered you a false reality, if I told you that there was an excellent, phenomenal chance that the Supreme Court was going to step in and deliver a victory to President Trump, I'd be lying to you. Now, you've known me for a long time now, and you know me long enough to know that I will not lie to you or simply tell you what you want to hear.
I had to keep that last part in because that's the funniest thing a conservative has said in literally years. I cannot lie to you. Laura Ingraham. Remember when Laura Ingraham, like 8 days ago, had that shadowy figure with the voice modulator that was going to prove all the fraud? But no,
How does she not have any like self-respect? The fact that she allowed that to happen on her show. Anyway, keep going.
Well, and by the way, like others in media saw that and thought, I gotta get me some of that. Rush Limbaugh yesterday was saying, like, they had this big press conference and they said they were gonna give us stuff. They should have at least had a hacker, and you could put a screen up in front of him if you wanna save his identity, and he'd say, I hacked this guy and I hacked that guy and I can prove fraud. That was a monologue from Rush Limbaugh saying, no, we're just gonna have effectively hand puppets obscured by shadow to vaguely prove all of our fantasies are true. Now there, she is acknowledging that Donald Trump isn't gonna be president, even though she holds out hope that the Supreme Court will deliver a win for him, which she knows damn well means the people don't decide, the Supreme Court decides if that were to come to pass. But the part I wanna briefly focus on there is that half of that statement was, hey everybody, keep watching. I'm not a traitor. I've supported the conservative populist movement, which doesn't exist. It's just conservatism. It doesn't mean I'm a traitor. I'm not a traitor at all. Keep watching. There was definitely some fear of strike back there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's terrified of the audience. The audience that she enabled with lunacy. She's worried that they're gonna turn on her for acknowledging what the reality is. And that's why, even though in the short term, it's the most frustrating thing and it feels like we're losing and no one respects or cares about the truth anymore, everyone just wants to hear what they want to hear. I mean, let me just be honest, there's a component of that on the left as well, right?
Totally.
If you acknowledge reality and you don't give certain audience members exactly what they want to hear, they'll revolt against you, they're angry, they're gonna go watch the Jimmy Dore show, have at it, please go enjoy, right? But it's a bigger contingent on the right, and it's because they've been enabled by so many people like Laura Ingraham. And when I say enabled, I mean basically persuaded to completely disregard reality and believe what you wanna believe alternative facts, believe whatever makes you comfortable in your own little bubble, right? While completely ignoring what the facts on the ground are. So I love that she's so scared of her own audience going against her because she has no choice. She has to acknowledge what the reality of the situation is. Biden won, he's president elect. There was not widespread voter fraud.
Yeah.
Whoever was on her show, you know, that shadowy figure who allegedly experienced voter fraud firsthand, that was a lie. That was a lie. They've never provided evidence. Every single court case that the Trump campaign brought to, you know, various battleground states have been dismissed because of a lack of evidence. So this is the situation, and people got to deal with it. Sorry.
Yeah, well, and look, she's wise to be concerned, because not only is OAN and Newsmax and, you know, other people who have a webcam and a graphics package they purchased for $5 online, they're going to try to get those people, and maybe even some people inside of Fox News might try to show that they're more loyal. Now, Tucker Carlson, a guy who had criticized Sidney Powell right at the right moment, because she was about to be ejected like a day after. This is someone that obviously people, I would say, spend 50% of each day tripping over themselves to give him credit that he doesn't deserve. He spent last night, while she was acknowledging reality, doing a monologue about how the 2020 election was not fair. No honest person would claim that it was fair. Because Tucker Carlson is a person that Andrew Lawrence, in a follow-up tweet, very rightly identified, is a guy that loves to say nobody could disagree with the points that he's making as a way to prove that the points are accurate. It doesn't actually work that way. But he believes that if you say that while looking at the camera with a really blank expression, that it makes you seem reasonable. So he's saying, no, the entire thing was rigged. He might be willing to go along with it, like he'll cover Biden when he becomes president, but this entire thing was stolen. That is the only reasonable position that you can hold. So he didn't have the shadowy figure, and he criticized Sidney Powell. But at the end of the day, that's all frosting. The cake is telling millions of conservatives that election was rigged. Any election we lose is rigged. You don't have to respect any of this, and keep watching me, because I'm gonna continue to tell you that.
Look, I actually agree with Tucker Carlson. The election was not fair. And it wasn't fair that prior to the election, a Trump loyalist, Louis DeJoy, who was very conveniently named as a postmaster general, tried to dismantle the post office during an election year where people were going to rely heavily on mail-in ballots. You know, it wasn't fair that the Trump campaign did everything and anything to spread disinformation about what the reality is in regard to mail-in ballots, voter fraud. I mean, the disinformation was endless. So I agree, it wasn't fair. There were all sorts of unfair things that happened leading up to Election Day. And despite all of these efforts to suppress voters, Biden still ended up winning.
Yeah.
Sorry. I mean, they tried real hard to prevent people from showing up to vote, from turning in their mail-in ballots. And then after the fact, the Trump campaign did everything and anything possible to cancel, throw out perfectly valid and legally cast ballots.
Yeah.
Biden ended up winning anyway.
And getting over 80 million votes for the first time in American presidential history. Totally.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
At some point, Donald Trump is going to transition out. So what happens to his followers? There's a society out there that's soon going to be run by Joe Biden, and they're going to have to be a part of it. Or will they? Because some are giving signs that they just want to back off of this whole thing, this whole being in America, participating in American politics thing. William Legate, an independent journalist, tweeted, "There is a growing movement on Parler of Georgia Trump supporters vowing to write his name in for the Senate runoffs in protest of the rigged vote. So I don't go on Parler. I got no interest in it. And if I was vocal on it, I would be banned, because for all that they talk about free speech, if you're a leftist, they literally ban you from the site. But apparently some of them are thinking, no, we're just gonna vote for Trump in every election from here on out. And I say, have at it.
Oh no, please don't do that. That would be awful. No, I am triggered. I need a safe space.
What a snowflake. No, you'll make me more of a snowflake if you don't even vote at all. But anyway, so that might have an influence on the Senate runoffs. I think there's a lot of influences that are going to affect it. And by the way, can't give you too many details, but we're going to be doing a special around those Senate runoffs, because of course they're incredibly important. Some are just backing off of everything. Others are saying, after being so law and order up until this point, that now all bets are off. My favorite modern day philosopher, Charlie Kirk, said, it is time to disobey all orders that violate our natural rights. No more curfews, lockdowns, or authoritarian measures. Disobey, resist, defy, open America. Although bear in mind, he's also the guy that tweeted, you cannot pick and choose which laws to follow. I guess you can. I guess he, like America, disagrees with Charlie Kirk. But anyway, apparently now the time for resistance has begun. And it's not just him, Anna. I saw on Dan Bongino, his Twitter profile is now just hashtag resist.
Oh my God.
Trump is still president and he's already resisting.
What are you going to do?
I don't know.
What are you going to do? I don't even know how to respond to any of this stuff.
Sure. Like,
yeah, including Charlie Kirk encouraging people to, by the way, Charlie Kirk's business partner and good friend died of COVID. So he knows. Wow. He knows the severity of the situation. He knows what the pandemic can do. The co-founder of Turning Point USA is dead from COVID. Mm-hmm. And this guy is, by the way, in his bunker, in his isolated bunker where he's safe from COVID, he's telling you guys to go out there and essentially ignore social distancing orders, lockdown orders, all of that. Because he doesn't care if you die, yeah, right? But he loves making money off of pushing that message.
Totally.
He's totally so disgusting. He's absolutely disgusting. And I mean, how else is he gonna pay for that coke habit? Allegedly.
Oh my God. Okay. And then finally, so this is really going to be, this is the coming together of a couple of different threads that we've been weaving in the show so far. So what is Laura Ingraham worried about? Laura Ingraham is worried that if she tells something approaching the truth, the people that she has got addicted to pundit drugs will start to pine for a stronger dose. It's a strained metaphor, but I've been working on it. And the issue is that there are pundit drug dealers out there with a more refined, pure version of it. So she might be willing to finally acknowledge reality, but right now out there on Twitter are people with tons of reach. I can't believe this tweet from Lynn Wood, who's supposedly a lawyer, although it's Twitter, so God only knows. Maybe this is someone that other people know, I don't know. This person has almost 600,000 followers, so I guess a lot of people know them. Tweeted just yesterday night, Hillary and Brad Raffensperger, the Georgia Secretary of State, overheard at an Atlanta cafe, not a hipster coffee shop, an Atlanta cafe. Brad, does bleach bit work on videotapes? Hillary, not as well as a hammer. Brad, any other way to destroy evidence? Hillary. If I had been in Nixon's shoes, I would have burned the tapes. To which Lynn Wood adds, felony. That tweet has over 15,000 retweets, and the replies are full of people saying, yes, it's happening. He's not done. Trump's gonna be president. It's all just nonsense. That didn't happen. Not a single bit of that actually happened. Mm-hmm. But Laura Ingraham doesn't control the right. Tucker Carlson doesn't control the right. There are a lot of crazy people out there that are still gonna believe whatever random tweet comports with what they want reality to look like. That was last night.
Yeah.
The transition has begun, but these people are never gonna accept it.
Well, the good news is since Biden has been elected, he's bringing dignity back. And as a result, we're gonna be able to unify with these people. And then maybe they'll accept reality then after we unify with them.
Maybe.
Dignity, decency.
Dignity. They're going to
new
rise
age in America.
Exactly. They're going to rise above themselves and realize that democracy is great and bipartisanship is even greater. That's what they're going to do. Anyway, you know, it's interesting because you bring up these Democrats that have no idea what time it is and who we're facing. Why don't we talk about one of those Democrats, actually?
Do it.
Dianne Feinstein has announced that she is not going to be seeking to remain the sort of ranking senior Democrat on the Judiciary Committee. As she put out a statement saying, after serving as a lead Democrat for 4 years, I will not seek the chairmanship or ranking member position in the next Congress, obviously depending on how those Georgia Senate runoffs go. I look forward to continuing to serve as a senior Democrat on the Judiciary, Intelligence, Appropriations, and Rules Committees as we work with the Biden administration. And she says, you know, why is she doing this? Well, apparently she's got a lot that she has to focus on. She's saying California is a huge state confronting two existential threats, wildfire and drought, that are only getting worse with climate change. In the next Congress, I plan to increase my attention on those two crucial issues. Oh, what do you know? Dianne Feinstein suddenly cares about climate change, sort of shallowly, in a comment or two. And we're going to have responses to that. But at the very least, Anna, she is not going to be, if the Democrats take over, she is not the Senate, she is not going to seek to become the chairman or chairwoman of the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, that's not good enough. I think Senator Feinstein should step down. I don't think she has any business being in government. I think that she has been an absolute disappointment, to say the least, on every issue, including climate change, by the way. When she was approached by young climate organizers who demanded acceptance of the Green New Deal, because really that's the only type of blueprint for doing what's necessary to mitigate the impact of climate change. The way that she responded to those young organizers was, I've been doing this for a while. I know better than you. Okay, I know better than you. So how about you turn around, get out of my office. Like she wasn't having it. So to use this ridiculous excuse of, oh, we got to focus on climate change. Like that's no, it's because you were a disappointment. And she was so awful in the Amy Coney Barrett confirmation hearings.
Yep.
That even corporate Democrats were furious with her. Chuck Schumer apparently had to take her aside and have a stern talking to or talking with her, because she not only gave Lindsey Graham a giant bear hug once the confirmation was over, she also uttered the words, this is the best confirmation hearing I've ever been part of. Amy Coney Barrett just like breezed right through. It was the easiest confirmation.
Maybe that's what she means.
And that was after so many people poured money into the DNC hoping that there would be some effort to fight that confirmation, but there wasn't. There wasn't even a minor effort, no effort at all.
Yeah, it's like the injury is they get a supermajority on the Supreme Court. Amy Coney Barrett really doesn't have to answer for her record, which barely exists anyway. We're all just told that she's the greatest legal mind of her generation. We don't have to have any evidence of that. We have no idea what she's actually gonna do on the court. And so she gets in. The insult then is Feinstein just said, you guys are the best. And you know what? I know the election is just in like 3 weeks, but I want to make sure that people know that all of this is acceptable. This is the best. You guys are great. There's nothing horrible or incredibly hypocritical about this. I couldn't believe that, to say that it was the best hearings ever. And yeah, obviously she can't be in charge of that. I don't know what she's going to spend her time doing. She says now she's going to focus on climate change. With what? You going to be pushing for the Green New Deal? You're gonna do nothing. You're gonna like push for some sort of light, like carbon cap, like in trade program. Like, what is she actually gonna do? Does her staff even know what she means when she says that she's gonna focus on climate change?
Yeah, she's not an ally in any way, like to the left. She's not gonna do anything about climate change. She has used her position of power to push for all sorts of goodies that would benefit her real estate investor husband. It's just,
yeah.
I've got no love for Dianne Feinstein, none at all. She's so disconnected and detached from her own constituents in the state of California. She doesn't care about climate change. She doesn't care about how California as a state is completely falling apart because of economic inequality. So I'm not going to miss her. I just wish that she would fully step down from the Senate. But stepping down as the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee is an okay start. I'd just like to see more. It's completely start, withdraw. Yeah. You know, Dianne Feinstein, resist being in any type of chamber, in any type of governing. No one wants you. Republicans certainly don't want you. The left doesn't want you. Be gone.
Hashtag resist. Sunrise Movement, by the way, is also calling for her to resign. Like, imagine she would never, she will never, she won't. But if she did, and then, you know, Newsom would never, won't. But if we could get like Katie Porter and Ro Khanna, or like Porter and Barbara Lee or something, like imagine how much improved the Senate would be by that 1-2 punch. It's not gonna happen for a number of reasons, but and she's just effectively, like, let's keep it real. I'm sure there maybe there's some people watching this that are fans of her. She was primaried the last time around. What has she done since then?
Nothing.
And between now when she finally steps down, because I'm assuming this is her last term, what is she gonna do? She's one of the most senior Democrats. That's a position of respect and authority. What is she going to use it for? I don't think she even has an answer for that. She is effectively just blocking that seat from being held by someone more representative of their constituents in California and the Democratic Party across the country. It is just a big boulder sitting there stopping more from being done. That's it. Yesterday in the program, we mentioned that John Kerry is once again going to be serving in the federal government. In this case, with President-elect Joe Biden announcing just yesterday that the former Secretary of State would serve as his special presidential envoy for the climate. Their transition team put out a statement saying this marks the first time that the NSC will include an official dedicated to climate change, reflecting the president-elect's commitment to addressing climate change as an urgent national security issue. And what has been fascinating about this is obviously, like, I'm inclined to look at John Kerry being involved, in the White House again as like a really sort of thing. Like, man, they never really go away, do they? Like to put it in historical context, John Kerry was the first president I ever voted for a billion years ago, and he is still hanging out. But perhaps more to the point for this position, the response to John Kerry being chosen as that special envoy has been very mixed. So there have been groups like Food and Water Action calling the choice an alarming red flag. The group's executive director accused Kerry of being a longtime apologist for fossil fuel fracking and a reliable promoter of false climate solutions like market-based carbon trading schemes. Which, look, if you look over John Kerry's past in this area, he does like, he focuses on climate change, but his solutions are often funneled through capitalism and through trying to provide incentives for corporations rather than strong government action to bar certain forms of energy production, generation, distribution, those sorts of things. And it certainly is not what I would describe as sort of the new style, the new generation of climate thinking that places it in the nexus of basically every aspect of American society and the economy coming together, because it really does touch all of those. John Kerry is not really that sort of person. Anna, when you heard about John Kerry being chosen, what did you think about him for this position?
No, everything you just said is 100% right. And I had a very similar reaction. I'm actually kind of shocked at the positive reaction that we've seen among progressives when it comes to various cabinet picks, including like Janet Yellen, for instance. But same with Kerry. I think that you hit the nail on the head. And in regard to the critique that you read, look, the one thing that you can't get mad at Biden about is he didn't lie to us when he was campaigning. He talked about how much he loves fracking. I'm not gonna ban fracking. I love fracking. We're gonna keep fracking, 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 fracking. I mean, he's of course he's going to choose someone who is who has a favorable perspective on fracking. But more importantly, I think that the very position that Kerry has been chosen for, not something pertaining to climate change, but specifically the angle that he would be focusing on in regard to climate change, the national security risk, that is something that I think Americans need to keep a very close eye on, because something that's starting to be discussed and, you know, looked into is this whole notion of ecofascism. And I'm worried about, okay, if we're going to tackle climate change from a national security perspective, what does that look like? Mm-hmm. Right? Because the United States is the top polluter and has been the top polluter. And because of our actions, other countries are paying the consequences. Certain parts of the world are quickly becoming, you know, either difficult to live in or impossible to live in. And so as we see huge populations of people, you know, migrate around the world looking for safety, how is the United States going to respond to that? Is it going to respond to that the same way we responded to Syrian refugees? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, yeah. We go into regions of the world, create instability, we militarize, we do everything that we can to ensure that our defense contractors are making the money they want to make. And then when there's a refugee crisis, we give everyone the middle finger, right? So I suspect that we're going to have a very similar reaction to mass migration that's fueled by climate change, which we overwhelmingly contributed to.
Yeah, and you know, this is obviously going to be a gradual process that is going to ramp up over time, but when it's happening, and maybe we'll be doing coverage of the 2038 election, or I don't even know if that's an election year for president. But you know, the right is going to be demonizing based on it, and they will have totally forgotten that they were ignoring climate change all along the way and saying nothing should be done. But then, man, once there's chaos and instability, they're sure going to be worried about it and running campaigns based on it. But anyway, yeah, as you did say though, the response from some progressives who I genuinely very much trust in this area has been pretty positive. And I think in part it is because this is the international envoy. So there's going to be other people domestically focused on climate change. John Kerry does have a lot of experience in diplomacy. Dealing with climate change is going to require a lot of international effort, and he has shown in the past an ability to get countries on board with things. So that is potentially the good side. What he will get them on board with is potentially a different thing. So we will have to see. But really fast, I do want to read some of the positive responses, including Greta Thunberg, who says good to know when John Kerry announced that he would be involved.
Real positive, real positive.
It is, good but to you know. It, when she has a negative response to something, she is not really loath to make it known. Right. And more to the point, I don't know Greta. I've never spoken with Greta, but Varshini Prakash, from Sunrise Movement, is someone that I have a lot of respect for and have spoken with many times. She says, I served with Secretary Kerry this summer on the Biden-Sanders task force, and one thing is clear. He really does care about stopping climate change. That's something we can work with. An encouraging move from the Biden team. Now I'm keeping my eyes peeled for domestic equivalent. She did work with him, and she has been critical of potential picks. There were far worse people theoretically, but people like Ed Markey was very positive towards this. He's been a big booster of the Green New Deal from the very beginning. Jay Inslee, who made his entire presidential run about fighting climate change, had a pretty positive response to it. This is just one part of what is going to be a lot of positions that are going to be dealing with climate change, but I suppose there are worse people than could be picked than John Kerry, but of course we'll be watching.
Yeah, he's not the former CEO of ExxonMobil, but that's a very low bar.
And that's nice.
Putting that out there.
Can I just say, can I really fast? We don't have to focus on anything. I just saw this and I thought it was so funny because it had to do with climate change. Ivanka Trump tweeted, fact, greenhouse gases generated by the US will slide 9.2% this year, tumbling to the lowest level in at least 3 decades. And I'm assuming that just must be some awesome thing that Trump did and not a natural consequence of our entire society grinding to a halt as a result of the pandemic that she and her father didn't care about.
Man,
it's just such a stupid thing to say.
She just ended up being everything and worse, like everything I suspected and worse, right? At first it was like, oh, maybe she's just going to be complicit. Remember when she was supposed to be the moderating force within the Trump administration? How hilarious is that?
Yes.
And then that quickly changed to, oh, well, she's complicit. But no, she enables. Like, there's no question. She definitely enables birds of a feather.
Yeah. Birds of a feather flying with aggressive idiocy.
Yes.
Just like, hey, fact, good thing happened. I don't know. It's like an axe murderer coming up and hacking your arm off and someone else pointing out, hey, you just lost weight. Like, well, yes, but context is key. Anyway. Yeah. Okay, with that, let's turn to slightly darker stuff. We're about to enter into the holiday season, holidays that I'm a big fan of. Unfortunately, it is not just a holiday season. It is a holiday season in the context of a continuing pandemic. And I've been trying for weeks now to get people to take that seriously. And I'm beginning to think it's not working. I want to show you something. This is a little infographic, a little animated infographic that I think might be one of the most terrifying things I've ever seen. Take a look.
Wow.
What you're seeing there is air traffic. That is, there's so many. And it just, it looks like the like our country is being swarmed by bumblebees.
Wow.
Every one of those is a plane full of hundreds of people, and they are freely mixing from basically every major city in the country. And we still have a couple of days. Those are the people who like left for their holiday travel early. There's gonna be some who are gonna be leaving tonight and tomorrow night. And it's a pandemic, and the warnings have been out there, but you see, like, how much faith do you have that people have heeded the warnings of people like the CDC and the damage report? Anna, this is shaping up to be a real dark holiday season.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would like to, I know that a lot of the focus is on individual behavior for good reason. But I do also want to focus on not just the lack of leadership that we've seen from Donald Trump. That's a given. We've talked about it in great detail for like 10 months at this point in regard to COVID and, you know, the spread of this pandemic. But it is kind of difficult to trust in the advice you're getting from your elected officials as those very elected officials proceed to live life as if the pandemic does not apply to them in any way. I mean, you have Gavin Newsom going to Maui to meet up with some lobbyists. You have Gavin Newsom, again, governor of California, going to Northern California to some fancy place called the French Laundry, which I only heard about for the first time last week, to again meet with lobbyists, not wearing a mask, hobnobbing, hanging out. And so when Americans see that from elected officials who tell us that we need to stay home, we shouldn't see our family members during the holidays, of course some of them are gonna scoff at it because people are tired. I'm not justifying the risky behavior, so let me just get that out of the way. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that in order to be a leader, you need to lead. That means doing things that are difficult. That means leading by example.
Yeah.
So if you're hanging out, okay, if you're the governor of New Jersey and you're out with your family eating dinner, you know, on the same day that you tell your constituents that they need to sit their asses at home and not see their families during the holidays, it's hypocrisy at its finest. You need to lead by example. And we're not seeing that by our elected officials across the board. I'm not just talking about Democrats. I'm not just talking about Republicans. Across the board.
I think you're 100% right. You know, and especially when we know that people are looking for an excuse to not care anymore. And like tons of them have been provided with that from almost day one by the right wing. But even some people who don't consider themselves Trump fans, like it is very difficult. And so they've been looking for reasons to think that it's not a big deal. And those sorts of things, like every one of these powerful, well-connected Democrats who finds ways that it doesn't have to apply to them, that sends that signal. And even worse, really, because like I don't know where Gavin Newsom lives. I don't know what his house looks like. And yet I kind of do. I think we all have a pretty good idea that it's pretty sweet, right? Like he's been holed up during the pandemic the way we have, but not really, because I bet it's a pretty nice place. And still he feels he has to go out to Maui, which I'm sure is lovely. You know, I've been to Maui. That's like the one big trip I've taken in my life. Really liked it. Don't need to go during a pandemic. And I honestly think that the people of Hawaii would prefer if you stop bringing your coronavirus to their island. But it is happening. People are traveling. As the BBC put it, it's an agonizing Thanksgiving dilemma facing millions of Americans. But it's not, though. Like, sure, it's Thanksgiving. It's a holiday. It's another holiday where we would love to get together and eat, which is pretty much what every holiday is about. But you don't have to do it. You know what's agonizing? Being on a ventilator is agonizing. You know what's agonizing? Losing your loved one is actually agonizing. Not being able to like sit across from another person while they pass you cranberry sauce is unfortunate. But you can still FaceTime them. You can still Zoom or whatever. You can do that. And you can live to have dozens of Thanksgivings in the future. And so there's still a couple of days. Maybe there's some people that are watching this that think, I love John. John's great. His advice is great, but he doesn't understand. It's different for me. My family takes it more seriously. And I hope for your sake that they do. But in case they don't, let me make one final pitch. You may not trust me and you may not trust some of the numbers, but there's a great tool that I just came across this morning. You can Google the COVID-19 Event Risk Assessment Planning Tool. The COVID-19 Event Risk Assessment Planning Tool. And what this is it lets you look on the county level across the entirety of the US, and it gives you the odds that in a family gathering of 10 individuals, what are the chances in your county that one of those 10 will have COVID? Just as a random chance. And so I decided I will use my own life as an example for you. So if I decided here in LA to have a gathering of 10 people, what are the chances that one of us would have COVID? 53%, slightly more than 1 in 2. But the thing is, I've had Thanksgivings in multiple parts of the country because I have different relatives in different parts. Maybe LA is just like really rife with coronavirus. Well, what if I went to my in-laws down in the valley in Texas? That's a 50% chance that 1 in 10 would have COVID. If I went to my mom's off in Pompano Beach, 60% chance that 1 in 10 would have COVID. If I went to my brother's in Atlanta, Georgia, 67% chance that 1 in 10 would have COVID. These are four totally different parts of the country, and your odds of getting it are better than a coin flip in all of them. Now, I hope that there's something about your area or about your family that means that you'll be better protected, but are you willing to risk your own health and the health of the people that you love on that chance, on that coin flip?
And in regard to staying emotionally stable and as happy as you can possibly be at such a difficult time, especially during the holidays, I've kind of learned to, you know, instead of focusing on what I'm going to be missing out on, right? Spending time with people I love or enjoying the holidays with people I love, try to look at the positives. So, hey, maybe you don't need to see the in-laws this holiday season. You know, just a little. No, and I love my in-law. I'm not talking for me. I'm just obviously. I know that other people, you know, have issues, and so you can avoid it. It's all about what you choose to focus on. That's all I'm saying.
And you know what? You may think, well, I love getting together in a big group because then I can make tons of food. Well, let me blow your mind. You can still make tons of food
for
just
you
and one other person.
Yes, you can. So am I.
I didn't buy a smaller box of stuffing. I bought the same exact amount of stuffing. Yeah, but now there's only two stomachs. And honestly, my wife doesn't eat that much. So
I get so giddy when I think about Thanksgiving. Like I love cooking, I love eating, I love being in my pajamas all day.
Yes.
Not having no makeup, no hair, no nothing. I'm just You can still enjoy the holidays while social distancing. Try, like, just stay safe, guys. Be responsible, stay safe, and try to ignore the poor example that we're seeing from our elected officials. Yeah. Do what's necessary to keep yourself and your loved ones safe.
Exactly. Now, we're about to transition into our big Thanksgiving conversation. Before we do that, though, Anna, because you mentioned that you like to spend the day in your pajamas, which I do too. Thanksgiving movie you like to watch? Is there anything like that?
Traditional Thanksgiving movie? No, I wouldn't say Thanksgiving movie. But I do watch Home Alone at least once during the holiday season. So that's a tradition.
You have to for Christmas. For me, that's my Christmas movie as well as the first Harry Potter. For some reason, that Christmas scene always like gets to me. For me, for Thanksgiving though, it's Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. I always associate that with Thanksgiving. But anyway, with that, you know what? We're talking about Thanksgiving. Why don't we talk about Thanksgiving? As we launch into this holiday season, Anna Kasparian and I would like to focus on the positive for literally the first time this year. and talk about 10 things that we're thankful for as we get into Thanksgiving. So I've got 5 things, Anna's got 5 things, and we also have some comments and tweets that were left by our audience members to the posts that we put on our official accounts. Anna, why don't you start off with giving us one of your things that you're thankful for?
Okay, so I thought about this carefully and I decided to list my 5 things in order of importance, starting with, I mean, this is all very important to me. But I'm gonna start with, you know, I guess in my world of very important things, what is the least important? Mm-hmm. So number 5, I wrote substances. And that includes
Clay?
No. I didn't want to have to choose one of these things. So I put it under the umbrella of substances, and the substances that I prefer are pot and whiskey.
Ooh.
So that's number 5.
That's a balanced breakfast right there.
Favorite dinner.
I love that. I'm gonna Matt, this would be my honorary mention. This is my number 6. But for me, it's been gin. That has gotten me through this pandemic is gin for some reason. I don't know. Maybe related to my actual number 5, which is my writing group. I'm very thankful for the couple of individuals in my writing group. And because I want to be a writer, I'm drinking more gin. That seems like a classic thing you do. We've been writing all throughout the pandemic. I am closing in on the end of the book I've been writing this year. And I 100% would have long since given up if not for my writing group to keep me honest on it. And so that has been a great thing this year, is meeting up twice a week for that writing group.
I love that. Aw. Should I give you my next one?
What's your number 4?
So my number 4 is nature, because nature has not only gotten me through this pandemic and this pretty awful time, but anytime I kind of need like to heal in any way, or if I need some solitude, some time to think, I always want to be out in nature, right? So these long walks that I go on have really helped. I've been going on super long hikes. You know, when my good friend Michael Brooks passed away, all I wanted to do was go hiking. And I like to go to places where you don't really run into other people. So I'm not like a big, I like hiking Runyon, which is like the Hollywood hike. There's a ton of people there, but I prefer being in places that are, feels like you're remote, even though you're still in LA County. Yeah. So nature, it's just, I don't know, looking at the flowers, looking at just how incredibly beautiful nature is, makes me feel better. So I'm really grateful that I can, you know, rely on nature to get me into a better headspace.
Yeah, anytime I see a random animal out and about, like a random rabbit or something, it's just always so like, oh my God, nature exists. I do like that. And I agree, Runyon is the exact opposite of nature. There are areas of Manhattan that are more natural than Runyon at this point. Anyway, my number 4 is part of nature. It is my dogs, my dog Hilo and my wife's dog Abby. For all of the reasons that I talk about in literally every show, I go home from work and I immediately cuddle up with my dog. And I bury my face in his fur and my allergies flare up in about 3 minutes, but it's great and I love it. He cuddles with me. He started to cuddle, like I'll be laying on the bed watching TV and he comes up and puts his back against mine and just like leans against me. And it's so adorable. Like, I don't know what 2020 would have been like without dogs.
They're the best. Well, Charlie is gonna make an appearance, but the placement is a little different for me.
Sure.
So for my third thing on my list, it's my health, right? So it really hit me the other day as I was out in nature, just kind of like reflecting on things. I started thinking about how there are a lot of things that we kind of take for granted. We don't really think about it much. And for me, one of those things is my health, and this goes beyond health, but I'm able to do what I do for work because of certain skills that I have and like the ability to learn, and just these are basic things. I mean, anyone can do these things, right? But I just feel really lucky that I'm able to do what I like to do. I'm capable, like I'm a capable person. So yeah. I guess I'm grateful that I'm healthy and I'm capable.
Yeah, you are. You know what? I've always described you as a healthy, capable person. My number 3 is going to be TYT, but by that I mean like both the company, but my career. Because this year has been incredibly disruptive to basically everybody's life, but I have been lucky enough that I have had this job that it's changed a ton. It's very different. It immediately became very different with the pandemic, but it didn't go away. I never had to worry that I was going to be, you know, out on the street or evicted. These are things that millions of people have had to worry about. And not just that I've had a paycheck, but the show became, the Damage Report became much more personal, sort of like the direct connection we have with our audience very quickly in the pandemic. And I think that that was very helpful for me, because this is a year that has really driven people apart from each other, from their coworkers, from society, from their government. And it's been nice to have a connection, and that has been provided to me by TYT. So obviously, you know, all of my issues, some publicly stated, some just that me and Anna know, with this entire industry and career or TYT or whatever, those all remain. But thank God for TYT during this year. It would have been even darker without it.
I like that. I like that. So for me though, TYT didn't make the list. But I am grateful for TYT. It would be my top 10 for sure. Although sometimes I feel like it's killing me, not TYT specifically, just what I do and what we have to talk about every day. But for my number two spot, I have family and friends. So that includes my incredibly supportive husband, incredibly supportive colleagues like you, John, my best friend Lauren, my parents who have been like the foundation for my life, for everything that I've accomplished. I wouldn't be able to do it without them. So I'm just so grateful for them. And last but definitely not least, you know, my nieces. I see them every Wednesday. They are just such a huge part of what keeps me happy and sane. And the great thing about kids is when you're with them and when you're really present while you're playing with them and engaging with them, it reminds you of a part of yourself that you kind of lost as you've grown up and matured and became like a professional, whatever it is. You know, you have to kind of act a certain way publicly all the time, and then you lose that childlike curiosity. And I think being around kids and really being present and engaging with them just reminds you of that childlike curiosity that you might have forgotten about. And I really love that.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I haven't seen like any of my family.
Oh, it's real. It's all I can't imagine. Like it's, I mean, a lot of people are going through that. And yeah. I mean, I'm very lucky because everyone in my family, and I have a very small family. I just have one brother, his wife, my parents, and my two nieces. And they've all been quarantining, staying home ever since the pandemic began, or at least ever since the pandemic was taken more seriously in this country in March. And so as a result, I'm able to see them. If I wasn't able to see my family, if I wasn't able to like play with my nieces on Wednesdays, I would, I don't know what I would do. I'd lose my mind.
That's adorable. Well, my number two is related, and it is, as you said earlier in your list, mine is for my family, I would say the health, although we have lost someone to COVID, but more specifically that my wife and I have gotten through this because we've been the ones quarantining together. And the reason I guess it's obvious, everybody's gonna say something like that, but I also, I really thought one or both of us would get it early on. Like I just sort of accepted at some point, one of us is gonna get this and we're gonna have to see what happens. And that early part of the pandemic, like we were like even just going out to get a little bit of food or whatever, was so concerned that I would like bring it back to her or something. So we've been, you know, very vigilant and everything. But I really did assume that one of us would get it. And thankfully we've been lucky from that. You know, not necessarily 100% immune to any sort of health things or anything like that, but at least not getting that within our immediate family and having it, you know, only affect our extended family to the extent that it has is better than I feared it would be at the beginning of the year, at least.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's we're so lucky. I mean, we're incredibly fortunate that we're able to do what we do. And we still have jobs, and our jobs are safe, like health wise. So, you know, yeah, we're very fortunate. So for me, I'm gonna let you guess, John.
I mean, I'm assuming it has to be Charlie. Even if you hadn't said, I would assume.
Is that wrong? Is it wrong that Charlie gets the top spot? Is it wrong that Charlie's the real MVP in my life?
It's the only way this list could have ever gone.
Why okay, this so year? Here's the reasoning. Here's the reasoning. Because all of the things that I listed, there are ebbs and flows, right? So with substances, that was my number five spot. You know, you can get a little too substancey. you got a little problem, right? So it's not all good. You got moderation. Nature, you know, you enjoy nature, but you also think about how we're rapidly destroying it. And it's not a given, right? And you can't always rely on going out for a long walk. It might be cold, it might be raining. This past summer, it was insanely hot for like 2 weeks where you couldn't even be outside. You felt like you were on fire the second you stepped outside. It was insane. Health, I mean, I'm healthy, but that's obviously, it's not a given. It's not constant. You know, I can still get sick. Family, we're humans. We have our conflicts. We have our issues. Charlie is a constant. Charlie is, no matter how awful things have gotten this year, he's just always been this consistent source of comfort, of love, of affection, loyalty, all of that stuff. Like, it's insane how much this little dog, you know, improved my life. Like, we adopted him in 2016 when I was like in the depths of awful depression, awful anxiety, didn't think I'd be able to get out of it. And Charlie was the catalyst for just improving my entire life. So he's got the top spot. I love my dog.
Well, I don't think anyone is surprised by any of this, but I'm thankful that you have Charlie as well, because it keeps you sane, which is good. And he's a great dog. He deserves that spot. He had a good chance of making it in my top five, action. I've barely seen him this year. Have I seen him this year? I actually don't remember. I'm sure I had at one point. Anyway, my number one is going to be the end of Trump, sort of. It's coming, like a transition away from this. Mm-hmm. And this is not the blind, you know, glee of some people that are like, yay, all the bad's gone. No, the bad's not gone, but some of it is. Some of it will be replaced, not with the best thing ever, but with better things. And what we have given ourselves in transitioning out of these years, once it's actually done, is a fighting chance on some of these issues. It is a chance and it requires fighting. Both parts of that, please bear in mind, a fighting chance. But we do have a fighting chance on some of these issues, including ones that we've talked about so far in the program today. The news wasn't always great under Obama, obviously. It wasn't great before that, but at least some of these just insane skeletons will be out of government. We won't have to deal immediately with Stephen Miller. We won't have to deal immediately again with William Barr and Mike Pompeo. Some of them will probably, you know, circle the drain and eventually be dredged up by whatever comes next from the Republican Party. I'm not blind to that, but we at least will get a little bit of peace, a chance to wage a more positive war on the issues we care about and the world we want to see, rather than just a defensive war to try to like sort of dull the edges of the blade that's been at our throat for multiple years. So that is what I am thankful for, that as we end the worst year ever, we're at least getting rid of some of the worst things ever.
Yeah, I think it makes sense to have that on your list for sure. I'm just a little, I think I'm a lot less optimistic than you are, just as a person overall. I guess it's just hard for me to like stop and enjoy the fact that Trump will be out of office, because all I can think about now is a lot of these cabinet picks for Biden are awful. You know, so but I need to take my own advice and just stop for a second and just pivot my mind to the positive. And enjoy that for even a little bit. And then I can move on to Biden's cabinet.
Now really fast, let's read a few of the submissions that were sent in. Obviously, Anna and I are thankful for a number of things which we've gone over, but audience members are thankful too. And I think it's important that it's been a depressing year. We put a pin in some of the things that we do have going for us. Nick is thankful for my health and for having my family healthy and still around. I know someone who lost a father to COVID. Exactly. Anyone who's been able to get through this without losing anyone should be thankful of that. Scott is thankful that he's still alive at all. So that's good. That's good. You need that for everything else. Leo is thankful that there's people like you that amplifies our progressive voice. Well, thank you, Leo. Anna and I are doing our best. DJ is thankful for planet Earth. We only have one and the orange one didn't do it much good. Keep up the progressive voice and recycle. Yes, while also pushing for environmental policies that are obviously going to be orders of magnitude bigger than any personal stuff. You still have to do the personal stuff, but you know, our government has a far bigger responsibility. Vanessa is thankful for her boyfriend, Chris. He has kept me sane while I get yelled at as a customer service representative for Medicaid and food stamps. I can only imagine being involved in any sort of program like that this year has got to have been even more hectic. Dominic Franco is thankful that I haven't gone insane. John Adirola hasn't gone insane. And also for board games and video games. I'm thankful for those as well, Dominic. Wendy is eternally grateful to have a roof over her head, food on the table, a good job, and a kitty who constantly insists on snuggles.
Oh,
it's like a little tiny Charlie.
Yeah.
Christopher is grateful for the fact that I'm still employed during COVID. Yeah, imagine like the economic strain on top of all of the fear around the pandemic and everything. And then every day to see that the government barely,
they don't care.
Barely did something for like a minute. Yeah. And then that was it. And they didn't feel, even in election year, they didn't have to do nothing.
Yeah, and then they yell at us for not staying home. Some people can't stay home. Some people literally have to work. Yeah. Because the federal government has completely abandoned them.
Yeah, there are people who have died because of COVID because they had to go work.
Exactly.
And they didn't have to go work if the government, including some people in government who want to do the right thing, if we had a critical mass. Anton is thankful this year for the same thing as every other year, Keanu Reeves.
Okay,
did not see that
coming.
Samuel is thankful for the fact that AOC is fighting so damn hard for the people. Madam Congresswoman, we see you. And I'll also add on that we've got some more good, you know, we got Cori Bush, we got Jamal Bowman, we got a number of other good, Marie Newman, we got a number of good people coming in that I'm thankful for too. Hopefully that will provide some dividends going forward for our politics. But anyway, to the audience, very thankful for you. Glad that you've made it this far. We've done it together. Thank you. Anna, I'm thankful for you, by the way. Thankful that you did the show with me today. Thank you so much for
John.
That.
John, you're the best. Everyone loves you for a reason. John's Thank a sweetheart. You. And I love doing the show, so anytime.
Thank you. Well, I know you got to get ready for the Young Turks, but thank you again. And have a good one. I'm talking as if you're not like right over there. I'll probably see you in like 10 minutes. Anyway, exactly. But bye for now.
As of this recording, Donald Trump still isn't ready to move on from the presidency. But assuming that he eventually does, should we move on so quickly from his presidency? There are still a lot of unanswered questions about some of the things that went on, even up to the final days. And now some in DC are calling for something akin to a truth commission to look into these still unanswered questions about his finances, about the pandemic response, and all of that. Is it a good idea? Could it actually work? Would it actually convince people of anything? Joining us now to break it down is the senior Washington correspondent for Business Insider, Dave Leventhal. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, John.
Glad to have you on. You have an awesome write-up about this Truth Commission available right now if people want to go read it on Business Insider. So what was the impetus for this?
Well, the impetus has been the past 4 years of Donald Trump. Ever since Donald Trump has become president of the United States, Democrats, of course, have tried to with more failure than success, investigate and ultimately kick Donald Trump out of office. We've seen this with House committees. We've seen this, of course, with impeachment. And the question now is whether the Democrats are going to have the interest in the stomach to effectively do that in retrospect, to go into 2021, looking backward to the past 4 years. And number one, take lessons from that and try to air them publicly. And also to kind of use this still as a bludgeon against Donald Trump to ensure that if Donald Trump runs for president again or stays as sort of the commander in chief of the Republican Party, that they're going to be out there fighting him tooth and nail.
And it certainly seems like even if he doesn't run for president, which behind the scenes, he's sort of indicating that he might run in one fashion or another, he certainly isn't going to be going away from Republican politics. As of right now, who's advocating for this and how seriously does it seem that they're being taken?
Well, right now, we talked to a number of different senators and members of Congress and the House in special interest groups, both on the far left and more moderate Democrats. And there's definitely very mixed opinions about this, John. You have some people who, on one hand, and we talked to, for example, Joe Manchin, who is not going to be mistaken as a far left liberal Democrat, about as centrist a Democrat as you get. He thinks it's a great idea. I talked to Rashida Tlaib, a representative from Michigan, who, of course, very progressive. She thought it was a good idea. So there are your bookends right there. And also talked to a number of different activist organizations and progressive organizations that felt like this is a necessary thing. The crux of their argument is that if we don't learn from the past 4 years, if we don't have a sort of independent, bipartisan airing of what has happened during the Trump administration, the old adage comes in that if you don't learn lessons from history, you are doomed to repeat them. So that is, again, going back to the impetus, another thing that's really animating and motivating this. So that's one side. The other side is Joe Biden. And ultimately, if you take him at his word that he wants to move forward and not effectively relitigate the past 4 years, and he's indicated that he wants to move forward in a major way, that's going to be a major stumbling block to any sort of truth commission that, mind you, would be in the vein of sort of what we saw after 9/11, after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, or after the BP oil spills, when Congress did, in fact, put together and support a bipartisan independent commission to do sort of a full airing that was unparalleled with Congress, but not part and parcel of a House committee or whatnot.
Yeah. Yeah. So far, Joe Biden doesn't seem like he'd be super interested in that, but doesn't mean it would require his approval. But it's hard to imagine it existing and being taken seriously by Democrats in the Senate and the House if it didn't. But you did mention there that ideally it would be bipartisan. And look, getting Joe Manchin on board is quite a bit of the way towards it being bipartisan. But has there been any Republicans who have shown any interest in this?
No, there has not. And so that's, of course, going to be the biggest stumbling block of all. All right, great. You can call it bipartisan. You can say that this is something that is nonpartisan. Well, the fact of the matter is, what Republican is going to sign up at this point to go and try to beat the heck out of Donald Trump for months and months and months, which is what a commission like this would entail? Now, the issue is important here. We asked the question a lot and put it to many people, both on the right and the left. What do you want to investigate? What exactly is the point of a commission like this if you go forward with it? And got a variety of answers. Some people are very interested in trying to get to the true bottom of how many norms Donald Trump has shattered, how many ethical boundaries that typically were in place for a president are no longer there and, in their opinion, would need to be put back and reestablished. COVID-19, though, was the one that if there was any sense of bipartisanship, if there was any sense of people coming together, I mean, that's affected Republicans and Democrats equally, and it's a pandemic. So the question there is not so much focused on Donald Trump the person, but the Trump administration writ large. And if you are going to have a commission like this, the notion of getting to the bottom of the government's response and the failures thereof during the COVID-19 pandemic seemed to be kind of the one issue that maybe there's a little bit of a gap there where Democrats and Republicans could get together.
Well, the thing that would, I agree that should be the biggest part. If it exists, that's an important part of it. It does seem to be a bit complicated by the fact that is a crisis that we're not out of yet. It's like one thing to look into, like, what happened in the lead up to Benghazi. Like, Benghazi was years past at that point. We're still not doing much about the pandemic. And there's every reason to believe that by the time you get the new Congress, it's going to be worse then than it is now. And so it seems like it's something that you couldn't wait too long before starting, but we're not quite even at the point where they could start it. We're still months away. But an interesting topic. It is interesting to see who is supporting it. I certainly would not have expected Joe Manchin. So that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. And, I don't think to that point that you're going to see on January 20th, when Joe Biden takes office, people in Congress clamoring to create this commission right out of the gate. I think what you're going to find out of the gate is, for example, the bill H.R. 1, which is a whole suite of ethics reforms and a big package of trying to, you know, effectively undo much of what Donald Trump's administration has stood for. That's going to be out of the gate first. But the notion of a bipartisan commission, I would expect under any circumstance, that's going to wait a little bit.
Yeah. Well, as of right now, every day we move closer to the inauguration. I believe, I could be wrong, Dave, but I think one of the earlier stories we talked about in one of your appearances here had to do with some of those donors to the Trump administration, lingering questions about that. Well, now we've potentially got a similar situation, or at least we could. So you've got a write-up on Business Insider about some of the large corporations that are interested in potentially funding Biden's inauguration, but we don't yet know exactly who is going to and who's not going to be funding it. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that's in part because Joe Biden himself, his campaign, his transition, has not said what this inauguration is going to be like. And of course, COVID-19 is looming over all of this. This is going to be as different an inauguration as we've ever seen probably in our lifetime, simply because of all the restrictions that are going to be in place. We have no idea what's going to be happening on January 20th, epidemiologically, health-wise. And as a result of that, we could be having a very, very small, truncated type of inauguration, devoid of the balls and the lunches and the brunches and the dinners and all the different trappings that usually come with this once every 4-year celebration. But that is not stopping corporations from saying, hey, look, if you guys are going to do stuff, we would love to send you money, because corporations, this is an opportunity for them and special interests of all sorts to really get in right on day one, get in the front door, put some money down, build some goodwill, and make sure that the new president of the United States and all the people around him know who they are and remember their name and remember the issues that they care about. That's a huge deal for corporations, which is why I'm not surprised that we heard back from Bank of America and Ford and Boeing and a few others who said, to one extent or another, yeah, we're pretty much on board with that if ultimately we have an opportunity to donate. Mm-hmm. But that's going to be up to Joe Biden to determine whether he takes corporate contributions or not. And that is strictly up to him. It's not a matter of law.
And so far, has he or his campaign said anything about that?
No, they declined to comment for our story. They wouldn't tell us, number one, about any of the finances around the inauguration, whether they will take corporate money, union money, nonprofit money, political money. And in the inauguration, when we talk about that, we're talking about not the thing that you see up on the U.S. Capitol where Joe Biden puts his hand on the Bible and swears the oath of office. That's a government function. We're talking about all the stuff and the swirl of activities that happen for days before and after, which is where the corporate funding or other money that's non-governmental comes in to play. So that's number one. We also don't know from Joe Biden what exactly the schedule is going to be. So are they going to have social events? Are they going to have the pomp and circumstance at any level? I would expect that there's going to be that at some level. I mean, Joe Biden's been waiting since 1988 to become president of the United States. So there's going to be something here, but to the extent, we don't know. And also, too, there is the possibility, and nobody has said this definitively, that something could be delayed, that instead of having all that pomp and circumstance right around January 20th, that maybe something after vaccines are delivered and the pandemic is largely behind us, that we do it a year from now or we do something else down the road. That's all unclear. And the Biden campaign is being very tight-lipped about this.
Yeah. Yeah. That seems like that would be a tough sell to really get people as invested as in the, because this isn't just Joe Biden becoming president, it's Donald Trump not being president anymore.
Correct.
This is sort of the moment. But like, so obviously they're not going to have gigantic crowds of people. Crowds might show up to protest or something, but I doubt Joe Biden is going to be asking for huge crowds to assemble for the actual day of event. They could, in theory, have those balls, but it's hard to imagine a more tone-deaf way to start off your presidency than having these gatherings that you've been saying people shouldn't have. And in theory, you could do it outdoors, but this is going to be Washington, D.C. in late January. So if you had to guess, what do you think? Is it going to be a small private ceremony? Is it going to be an outdoor thing with masks? How do they have something that ushers in this new era without giving the right tons of ammunition to attack all of their COVID comments over the past year as being hypocritical?
Well, I think we have a bit of a template from what Joe Biden did in the final days of the campaign and in the days after the campaign. He had events. Okay. He had people gathered at those events, but everything was socially distant. Everyone had a mask. There were definitely major restrictions put in place. In some cases, people were in their cars for outdoor events. So whether it looks like something similar to that or something that's going to be different, but sort of the same restrictions put into place, that seems to be something that worked and was made for TV as well. You could still show that to a national audience. The deed of the day was being done, whether it was Joe Biden giving a speech, whether it was him accepting the, you know, basically the victory that he won on November 7th. So that those could be definite options. All indications at this point, at least from the government side of this, is that the actual inauguration where Joe Biden swears the oath of office is going to be still at the U.S. Capitol, but it may look a lot different and people may be spread out a heck of a lot more than typical. Yeah. And we have no idea what's going to come about when it comes to people gathering to watch the ceremony and whether they're going to be all through the National Mall, whether that's going to be restricted, up in the air at this point, John.
Yeah. Well, and finally, I know if I had to bet, I would say that you are going to be closely watching when those donations actually start to happen. But
correct.
Exactly. So based on the last time around, how much disclosure, how much transparency is there on this sort of fundraising? If I recall, Donald Trump, who raised an incredible $100 million or something like that, wasn't it? Yep. That we still had a lot of unanswered questions about exactly who gave what. Isn't that so?
Yeah, the rules of the road are that you have to ultimately disclose who gave you money, but you don't have to disclose as a presidential candidate turned president where you spent that money. So what we can tell you is that in 2013, Barack Obama, he accepted corporate contributions. He had a, you know, very, very nice big inauguration. And Donald Trump in 2017 did all of that, took corporate money and took it to new heights and basically had no restrictions on who could give money. Now, he's also subject to some legal action in terms of how that money was spent. There was a lot of messiness there, but he took money from a whole variety of sources and took in more money than any president in U.S. history when it came to money for an inauguration. So the rules, again, are really up to the candidates. And that's one question that Congress may grapple with, is whether they want to clamp down on that type of activity, because you know, an inauguration, John, is about as swampy as it gets. And because those rules are not in place, for better or for worse, it gives entree to a lot of different special interests to plunk down a whole bunch of cash and endear themselves to the incoming president, which many Democrats find to be just patently unseemly at its face, either for Republicans or for Democrats.
Well, you can add me to the unseemly column. I'm not a fan of it. Can't wait to find out which ones, if any, are on there. And if you'd like to know some of the corporations that are apparently trying to line up to be in that group, Dave's work is available right now at Business Insider. If you want to learn more, both about the Truth Commission, the possibility of that, as well as the inauguration funding, you can go take a look at that. Dave, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you, John.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.